You're listening to the Agony Column News Report, featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony.
Michael Katakis is a writer, photographer, a fellow of the Royal Geographical Society, and manager of the Ernest Hemingway Literary Estate. His photographs are represented in the National Portrait Gallery. He's the author of Traveler, of Dangerous Men. His newest works include A Body in London, Road Songs, and he's got a play coming out called Night Train. Fill me in. Michael, you are a busy guy.
Not as busy as you, Rick, but busy. Yes, yes. Quite busy.
Your two new novels are published under an imprint of Scribner, called Crow. Talk about creating a new publishing house.
Well, you know, Rick, that has been a dream of mine for almost 30 years. And about 17 years ago, I had mentioned it to Patrick Hemingway, and Pat said, you should do this. You should go forward. But, you know, I had other things. I was still being published by Simon & Schuster in the United States and Montadori in Italy and Gallimard France. So I just kind of rolled with it, but it was always in the back of my mind. I wanted to create a publishing company very similar to the publishing companies that kind of sprouted up after World War I in 1920s and 30s Paris, where they took risks with writers that the establishment was not ready to go with, like Ernest Hemingway, Ezra Pound, these kinds of people who weren't welcome at that time in the literary establishment. So I thought there was room for a publishing company that was actually a publishing company in these days, that Simon & Schuster has been purchased by a hedge fund. So, you know, I don't think in the 20s hedge funds even existed, but now they seem to buy up newspapers. And so we wanted to do something different. We wanted to go back in time so we could go forward.
One of the things I was thinking as I was reading these books and the play was, you as an artist, you're a man who has achieved, you know, the pinnacle of photographic artistry. You have achieved the pinnacle of writing. You've written your recent fiction, but you've written travel books. You wrote with your late wife, Kristen. You did a lot of scientific kind of studies. So I'm wondering, were you always an artist? I mean, as a kid, were you the kind of guy who would, you know, sit around and draw pictures or write books?
You know, that's a terrific question, Rick, because when I look back on it, I think I was always reaching out for something. I think I've always been uncomfortable with myself, like something's missing, looking for something. I'm sure that I'm not alone in this. I'm sure that a lot of people feel this way, but there was this constant creative calling, but I had no idea what it was. Originally, I thought it was music, where I was involved in music. But it took me a number of years to realize it was writing. It was writing. And so the journey has gone all about. But as a kid, there's a rumor in my family that I'm related to Nikos Katsenzakis, who wrote The Last Temptation of Christ. Okay. And Zorba the Greek. So this did not go down well with a lot of the Greek people because it was sacrilegious, you know, against God. So when the old Greek women My aunts and my family saw me as a little boy picking up a pencil and constantly writing. I remember them always crossing themselves, terrified that, no, not a writer. Please, we have one and he's terrible, you know? So I think I was always trying, and it took a long time to find my path. As a matter of fact, I'm still looking. I'm still looking, and I think maybe that's what it means to be an artist, that you're never completely satisfied, that you're constantly trying. You know, you talk to a lot of artists and writers, so, you know, I would think you would know better than I.
One thing that struck me was that one of your great strengths as an artist was telling a story through pictures, photographs in particular. And I think that that's, you know, the old adage, a photograph is worth a picture is worth 1,000 words, depending on your, translation rate there. But as I read both the books, your new books, and the play, I thought really interesting to me, because your style is very minimalistic. Long ago, I interviewed Chuck Palahniuk, and he said to me very seriously, he said, "Rick, I'm a minimalist." And I thought, okay. And I imagine you could say the same thing. Your style is very stripped down in prose, and you tell the story mostly through dialogue. And I think that it's so interesting that on one hand, you take pictures, but you don't describe them so much. You let the people in your stories describe them. So I'd like you to just talk about, you know, your sense of what a story is and how you tell it. Pictures of what's going on around us, you know, you can just immerse yourself in the video clips of today and get one picture of the world, and you can immerse yourself in the conversations of the day and get a very different picture of the world, or maybe a nicely complementary one. So talk about your sense of story, pictures, and words.
Well, what I think, when I am stripping down language, I am stripping the language down, and I'm leaving more room for your imagination to fill in things that become very personal to you. I'll give you an example. If I was writing a short story, I'm working on one right now called Still Life, and it's about a woman who gets her coffee in the morning, walks out, greets people she knows, is looking at her phone, she's answering a text, she is standing with a group of people, and she walks out into the street and is immediately struck and killed, and there she is lying in the street. And still life. And then what you have is a few conversations happening of people. Of course, there are some who are taking pictures of her. There are some that are running to help her. There are some engaged in dark humor. But the trick there is to let the reader fill in what others would perceive as blanks. And what happens is your imagination kicks in. And rather than me telling you a story, in an odd way, you become part of the story too. You interject your own view of it. You participate rather than just being a voyeur.
That's the trick to writing the kind of books that people want to read. I read both of your books just addictively, because it's hard to put down.
Thank you. I'm glad to hear. That's the first time I've heard that, because not many people have read it yet. So I'm very glad that that's the case.
Well, I think, you know, they're really fun to read, and that's important. Let's go to first talk about A Body in London. I just picked that one to read first. And I think it's such an interesting book. It's such an odd duck in so many ways. I enjoyed the hell of it. You know, if somebody asked me to describe what this book is like, I'd say, well, you know, it's kind of a Sherlock Holmes murderless mystery set with a detective like Sherlock Holmes set after World War II, as written by Ernest Hemingway.
That's very funny.
It's so much fun to read. So talk about your decision to, you know, mine the old tradition of detection novels of mysteries, but to kind of invert them in totally in a number of ways.
Well, I've always loved mysteries, always, just like millions of other people. I've always loved them. I've loved when they've been adapted to the screen. I've loved them as books. I've just loved them. But I always wondered if I could write one. You know, it always was kind of in the back of my mind, oh, one day I will do this. But I didn't think I could, quite frankly. I thought they're a genre that is very clever, and I'm not clever in my writing. So I started this with this character, Thanatos Boyd, and something shocking happened. And I started writing the character in the opening, and the characters started every morning to tell me what to do. I know that sounds bizarre, but it was like every morning waking up and going to the cinema. And I've never had so much fun writing a book because I'd like to say I wrote the book, but these people were, the characters were extremely irritating and insistent on what I should do and where I should go. So it was great fun. And I wanted it to be fun, something that I'm not known for, Mr. Fun. That's not, you know, I'm usually known as Mr. Dark, Death. And so I said, seeing that let me make a little fun of myself, and I'll name the character Thanatos, the god of death, who's also Greek. So, you know, here we go with all the strands. But I just had a good time, and I was hoping when the book was finished that other people would have a cup of tea, sit by the fire, and have a rollicking good time.
Mission accomplished. That's exactly what I did. Well, I had a giant cup of latte, but that's fine. It was really fun. And I have to say, one of the things that was nice about this book, because, it, you know, all your characters are very laconic. I mean, they say about the minimal, especially Thanatos Boyd, say about the minimal. And Thanatos Boyd, you know, is on the, well into, quote, the spectrum, I think. And, you know, the way I saw the character play out is, I think that you need to get Martin Clunes, the fellow who plays Doc Martin, to play him, because he reminded me of that character. Somebody who just says exactly what he thinks, nothing more, nothing less, without any regard to, you know, without any, quote, apparent regard to how it affects the people. But really, part of the reason he speaks that way is to see how other people react. And I think that's interesting because, to me, at least in this book, the storytelling lies not in the dialogue, but between the dialogue. And that's why, as you say, the reader really participates in this.
I think what makes the book, at least for me, interesting is he is not the main character, either the hero or the good guy. As a matter of fact, I think Thanatos Boyd is a sociopath. And he is a very, very dangerous character. And he's someone who we assume through the book until the end is quite capable of cold-blooded murder.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Sherlock Holmes was many things. What he wasn't was a murderer. And so what I was trying to do in the book, or what they kept telling me to do, no, don't make me the good guy. Don't make me the good guy. I may be as dangerous as the person who is murdering people, who is a mass murderer on the street. And that's where I think the miscalculation happens from Macris. Macris assumes that this is a person who will play by the rules, and he doesn't.
No, this is a person who makes the rules, and it, to his advantage. I really, one of the things I found that just so delightful are the other characters, the newswoman, and especially the pet, his dog, is a delight. Do you have a dog?
I do.
Oh, okay. Do. Well, that makes sense. I was.
I do. I do. And I think he sums it all up when that line where he says, I love animals. They are unacquainted with betrayal. And I think that says it all. He has, if there is a soft spot in this sociopath, it is with creatures, animals. And I think the only difference is that character, Noor, who, by the way, is a real person. There are a lot of people in the book who were real people.
Mm-hmm.
And Noor was a real person who actually died the way she dies in the book. And he, as they say, this may be the only time in his life he came close to what love might feel like. And so, yeah, he's a strange bird. But someone said to me that Boyd, I reminded them of Boyd in certain areas and of Tom Ryder in the other book. And I really had to think about that. And I came to understand that there's a part of that that's true. That there is a very, very dark side of me. Mm-hmm. And I, for instance, I love killing people in books. I can't tell you. I can't wait to murder someone else. I find it so rewarding. I mean, I'm thinking of Trump right now and a number of other people, you get all the pleasure without any of the consequences when you murder people in books. And it's really delicious. I mean, I sleep very well.
It strikes me, when you were writing this and the characters were talking to you, did you think, this is the dark side of me who would kill people? It had either chance and the opportunity and the means and motive? Or did you just think, I'm having a good time writing this?
No, I've asked myself long ago, if I was pushed to the precipice. One can never know until it happens. But I came to the precipice and understood that in a terrible situation, could I commit murder? And the answer was a resounding yes. That was a shock to me, watching what's happened in Minneapolis. Could you see, I'm the son of a resistance fighter in World War II, could you see the ICE agent who killed Miss Good? Could you see him being killed? Of course. I think most decent people would say it. They don't want to. They don't want it to happen. Or maybe they do. But I think this darkness is in us all. I don't think Thanatos was particularly special. I think he was a product of his environment and what happened to him. And I think sociopaths are born. I don't think they're made.
One of the things I really liked about this book, and you alluded to this, was all the real characters in it. Did you have to map out their movements in advance and have Boyd and Macris kind of move in between where they were, or did you just like let it flow and bring these people in where you could?
I think the latter is true, Rick. I knew so much about Lawrence of Arabia, for instance, already.
Oh, right. I know you're a Lawrence fan, so as I read this, I thought, oh, wow, he's having fun now.
Yeah, and you're absolutely right, I did. What was so much fun was turning the Lawrence, mythology on its head when it was really Thanatos Boyd who did all of these things and gave the credit to the... to Lawrence, because Thanatos didn't like attention. And of course, the woman, her name has just gone out of my mind, the woman who is a spy as well, her name just went out of my, she's a real person who was a real person with OSS and with Vera Atkins. My wife just said it in the background. She was a real person who was with the special operations executive. And so were the three women, the agents who were killed by the Nazis. Those were real people. And of course, Winston Churchill. And I forget who else, you know.
As I read this, one of the things I really loved was the feel of, you know, a mystery, but without any of the appliances. You know, there are murders, but none of the deaths seemed in any way unnatural. I thought that was, you know, as I said, a murderless mystery. Did you set out to write a mystery without murders when you yourself just confessed that you would be capable of murder?
Well, I wanted a murderless book that was murder.
A mission accomplished. That's a conflicting kind of goal there, my friend.
Yes. You know, the only thing that indicates that it's murder throughout is this constant notes being left. Now, either this Macris is wandering around the streets of London looking for people who've collapsed and died in the street and just pinned a note on them, or they have been murdered, you know, but no one can figure out or prove that they're murdered. And I think Thanatos knows way ahead of time what has happened and keeps everyone in the dark.
That is a really interesting plan for a mystery, to have a detective who has solved the crime early in the novel, but conceals it even from the reader to let the reader have the pleasure of the other characters around him. And I think, you know, the conversations, the dialogues in this book are wonderful. I think it's one of the things that makes it so compulsively readable. There's a lot of empty space on a page. You can just turn these pages really fast, and it's really fun. So do you deliberately reduce paragraph size? Do you look at the physical layout of the words you're writing when you're writing and say, oops, can't have a paragraph that long. Somebody's got to say something here.
It's interesting you say that, because, again, I would write something down and I'd write a paragraph, and let's say I had a half a page of dialogue. It was like there was these little voices going, I didn't say that. I would say that. And I'm going, holy cow. So that was me writing what I would say. But then the character is saying, I wouldn't say it that way. You know, almost as if the characters were saying, you're an American and I'm a Brit in 1948. I wouldn't say that. And it was really a I've never written a book like this that was so much fun. It was arguing with characters that don't exist. And that was just crazy, but it was great fun. And the only reason I would write another one with this character is simply for that reason, that it was just so entertaining for me.
Well, I'd say it was entertaining. It was entertaining for your audience too. It was really fun.
I'm so glad to hear that, Brad.
One of the things I thought was interesting was the kind of contrast between kind of, you know, the murders that we know are not murders, you know, it's a mystery after all. So, and kind of, you know, the grisly nature of some of the stuff. So with that, with the absolutely charming, you know, almost like sitcom-like interludes with the, you know, the cats and the dogs and you know, these kind of like little old ladies and little young ladies and little old men and big young men sitting around, you know, and drinking tea and feeding their pets. It's a very interesting contrast between that and, you know, the more dark nature of the entire narrative. So talk about, you know, immersing yourself in that kind of charming fun.
Yes, well, you know, living in England part of the time, it has been very easy. The thing that's so irritating about the British is they are constantly, unflappably polite. It's just extraordinary. I've told some of our neighbors where we live, when they've just constantly so polite and generous, I go, knock it off. Will you stop it? I just can't take this kindness anymore. And it's very funny to me, but yet it's real. It's real. And so what I was trying to do in the book was replicate what I was experiencing. On the one hand, remember, Thanatos is half American.
Mm-hmm.
Half American. And he is someone who has gone through the British educational system. He has gone through the culture of England, and yet he is very much apart in many ways. People understand that he's very dangerous. I think what's curious about this character is he is likable in most of the book from a distance. Where he becomes not likable and where you can see the evil side, a terrible side, is in that last scene with Lord Harney.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes.
You know, all of a sudden, it's interesting, the gentleman, the British, I believe he's British, who did the audiobook for Simon & Schuster of this, I was really taken at the end of the book, his narration. He captured that moment and who Thanatos was better than I could have imagined. It came to life, and the way he intoned what Thanatos was saying, I got chills. I got chills because I realized at that point how very dangerous this person was, how wrong, something is terribly wrong with him. And yet he has the tenderness to care about Hester and these other characters, especially the woman, the old woman who used to sell flowers. And was killed by Macris.
One of the things about this book that I thought was really interesting was the feel for the place and the way it's interesting too that you evoke the place through what people say about it and how they feel about it, as opposed to saying, oh, outside there were this and this and this. And I'm wondering if this kind of split for you might be the result of your split as an artist in that you deal in the purely visual photographs versus the purely written word where you tend towards dialogue. If that part of your mind that takes the pictures is operating while you write the dialogue to say, you can't possibly convey this in words. Give it up, dude. Just to say what people write about it, or just write what people want to say about it.
Yeah, you know, I've never thought of this. You brought something up right now that has brought a certain clarity to me of understanding. When I was taking photographs, I always was unsatisfied. I was unsatisfied because I thought photographs, at least mine, I needed words. Words, I saw them not as separate. I saw them as complementary. It's interesting what you say to me now, because when I'm writing, I need the visual in my head, because the words alone are not enough. So maybe that's why the writing starts to become so visual, is because I never thought of it this way. I always thought of it, the photographs needed the words, but I think you're right. I see the pictures in my head, that, and the words are complementing the pictures are complementing the words.
This brings us to your other novel, Road Songs. It's, I guess, more of a novella, and as far as that goes, A Body in London is short. It's a very short novel. Talk about using, your sense of economy is great, because A Body in London and Road Songs both feel like full novels, full stories, yet they don't read that way, and they're, actually much shorter. Talk about, the import of economy in your writing.
For me, it is very, very important. You know, I have a friend in Paris who is a very fine novelist who is from Italy. And she... we had coffee the other day, and she said, "I hate the short stories. I read your writing, Michael. It's so fine, but I want them more. I want them more." Well, what I said to Sabrina is, sometimes that's all there is. Sometimes that's all there is. And I said, it is better for people to say, "I wish there was more," rather than, "Geez, I wish this book was 100 pages shorter," where you keep filling. I think the idea of economy is not consciously made. I think what is happening is, how do you tell this story that the reader will want to turn the page? And how do I write this story where I don't explain to you, I tell the story, but again, I leave room for you. I leave room for you and your imagination. Case in point, as the character in Road Songs is wandering these open, deserted highways, what more do you have to say to the reader than he's driving down open, deserted highways with horizons that never end? You now have a picture in your head that you will take along with that. I don't need to explain, "And oh, by the way, the sun was falling by the mountains over there, and I was doing this." I'm not there to overwhelm. I'm there simply to tell the story. And for me, that story works best with the least amount of explanation and words.
And I think, too, it makes for a more satisfying reading experience, in that, as you said earlier, leaves more room for the reader to put themselves in the narrative. And I think this gets to the heart of your art, both photographic and written, in that you have a very strong sense of storytelling and understanding of story outside of the art form which is being used to tell the story, which is to say that a photograph, a single photograph, you can see, like in some of these pictures of you know, the recent events in Wyoming, you can see the story. You don't need to see, read it. You don't need anything. You can just see, you know, the people on the street, the woman in the car. You can see what's happening. You do not need the story, and you really don't want it. Your brain puts those things together in the same way when you're writing. We don't need to see pictures of the sunset or the hills or the road. We've all been on the seen sunsets. We've been on the road. We've seen the low-life motels and truck stops. So, we take pleasure in putting the things together. And I think that is really goes to the strength of your writing and your photographs, which is that you understand the parts that, you know, enable us to get that from A to B, and you get it from A to B and let us enjoy the journey. It's more, like the old cliche, it's not the destination, it's the journey.
Right. And for each person, what makes that space is the work or the story will be filled in with places with unknowingly people's own experiences. For instance, there's a part of in the book of Road Songs where the young boy's father is taking them to California from Chicago to start a new life, and the cities open up to open fields, and there's a part of, I'm trying to remember where it is, where the boy looks and at night the stars are dancing on the rivers that they pass, the reflections of the stars. You don't need to say more than that. That's a single photograph, the reflection of the stars on a river moving through. And you don't have to elaborate. I think the danger comes when you're writing fiction is to elaborate too much. I'll read a book, a novel, and I can tell immediately when someone is putting in filler to make the book long, but it's not necessary. But they're putting it in because they have to get it to 250 pages, or they think this will add to the story or whatever. And it, in my opinion, it does a disservice to their often wonderful story to put too much in. But that's just my opinion.
Are you editing, going to edit books for your publishing, for Crow Books?
Yes, but I wouldn't dream. We have an editor in New York who, and my wife is a brilliant editor, but I would not dream of forcing or imposing how I write my own work on another author.
Well, no, yeah, I don't think you could, because your work, it's like when I can tell you right now that I could read anything you write and pretty much immediately say, oh, that's Katakis, whether or not it, because you have a very strong and individual voice.
Oh, boy, that's thank you. I've not heard that before.
Well, also, too, I mean, when you strip things down, you get to say smart things and they really stand out. Right here, I'll read a bit from the Road Songs book. He's talking to one of our waitresses at one of the many truck stops. He says, you doing okay? Ride the train, Tommy. Can't complain. And besides, what good does it do? We just got to get on with it. What? living. We have plenty of time to be dead.
Yeah. And people actually talked like that in Montana, you know? It's not like I'm making something up. That was the kind of banter, you know?
And two, I think this benefits from, you know, who you are. There's a lot of working stiff guy in you. And did you spend how much time of your life have you spent in the working stiff category?
Not long. I mean, from the time I was growing up in Chicago, I had different jobs up until 17 years old. And then when I was traipsing around the world, I was in kitchens washing dishes so they could give me free lunch and sleep on the banquettes at night because I didn't have enough money to live. So I'm certainly not of the the tough, long-standing working class roustabouts, but I had some of it. And my uncle, who owned a bar in Chicago in the factory part of town, and I would go there and listen to these guys in their overalls. And I remember my uncle, you know, Chicago was a pretty racist place when I was growing up. I suspect it's the same now. But in my uncle's bar, there were black guys and white guys, all different kind of guys, and an axe handle behind the bar that my uncle insisted that this was safe space when people came into his bar and everyone got along. So that Chicago upbringing, if I wasn't part of that working group, I sure knew how they talked and how they acted. Yeah.
I really like, and I'm surprised, this road song's The Story of Tom, because, you know, he's a really handsome guy. He's, you know, a talented writer. He's won a Pulitzer Prize. I mean, there are many aspects of him that where I just see, you know, he'd see it abstractly put down. Handsome guy, movie star, Pulitzer Prize. I mean, you know, this is a three strikes, you're out, dude.
Yeah, you know who he's modeled after? He's modeled after Sam Shepard.
Okay, well, there you go. That makes...
Yeah, he's modeled on Sam Shepard because Sam Shepard would often say, you know, I'm a writer, I'm not an actor, and I take the jobs for the money, you know. Sam Shepard had an extraordinarily funny story about The Right Stuff, the movie that he would tell. And it really affected me when I heard it because I said, you know, I think there's a story, and this started the idea for Road Songs to some extent. And he said that the reason he took the movie is he read the script, and the first part of the script is he's on a horse racing his wife down in the Mojave Desert. And he said, I'll do it, you know. That was his motivation for doing the movie. And he shows up with his horse trailer with his own horse. And the wranglers are going, hey, you know, Sam. And he goes, I'd really like to use my own horse. And he said, well, you know, Sam, you're not going to be riding. You can't do the thing that we're doing. We got two horses that look alike for the stuntmen. And Sam said, well, geez, I'd really like to use my own horse. So the wranglers figured it out, and they had a cactus, and the cactus was one of those big Seguro cactuses, and they cut off one of the arms and put styrofoam in it because they were supposed to ride the horse and ride into that arm and break it off. Well, what happens is the wrangler gets on, he takes off, he's supposed to go to the arm, but the horse sees one of the lighting cables below and thinks it's a snake and runs directly into the cactus, throws the stuntman into the cactus. He breaks his collarbone, I guess. He breaks his ribs. He's in the hospital, and Sam feels terrible, and he goes and he sees the guy. And the guy's, you know, like in traction and everything. Sam says, I'm sorry. I'm sorry about this. He said, oh, Sam, don't worry. This is my job. These things happen. He said, you know, you got a nice horse, but when it comes to cactuses, it ain't worth shit. So this was the kind of characters that I kept thinking of. And of course, the movie director, John Huston, is based upon John Huston.
I figured as much, and he directed one of my favorite movies. You couldn't show it anywhere now. His adaptation of Wise Blood was absolutely stunning. A Flannery O'Connor novel, but just due to the content, you could not, it would not go well. One of the, let's talk a little bit. To me, the play seemed the ultimate evolution of the two novels. And
that's a nice,
finally, you know, it's only story told only in words. And I think that, you know, this plays to your strength of telling stories. So talk about your decision to write a play. I think you said you are interested in writing more. What brought you to the point of writing a play, which is, you know, not, maybe not the, Mom, I'm going to write a play. Oh, my God. Good luck with that.
Kind of... A friend read a short story I had done and said, you should think about adapting this to a play. And I went, I don't know how to do that. I don't know. But the deeper I went into it, the more I fell in love with the process. And the more it really spoke to me. Now there was no place to hide. Everything had to be dialogue. Everything. There was no explaining about the stars' reflection dancing on the river. None of that. It was pure dialogue. What interested me and also what worried me a little bit about writing a play was I live in a luxurious place of loneliness because a writer has to be alone. And it is not a collaborative art form. It is just me. And in here, you're living in your world. With a play, it is now collaborative art. If you want a play to do well, you find fine actors. Even a mediocre play will do well with fine actors. So I was concerned about this, but I went ahead. And the more I went into it, the more I fell in love with it, because now, as you said, it was pure dialogue. And how would these people talk? What's important in this play to understand is basically a few things. One is everybody is lying all the time. Everyone is lying. Everyone. And they continue to lie until the very end. The other thing is, it is a portrait of tragedy and madness in the faces and the exchanges of people that, when it comes to one person, cannot face it, will not face it, and will be broken and destroyed by it. It is the face of madness. It is the conversations of madness. And there was something very compelling to me about that. I believe when you go into the dark side of ourselves, I don't think most people are prepared to ever do that, because when you come back out, you can never be who you were. The illusions that you had about yourself, that you told yourself about who you were, no longer work.
We always tell ourselves lies and you know, try to invent new stories, but the darkness does not allow us to tell ourselves lies. If we would stop telling ourselves lies, we'd be a lot better off.
And that's what makes going deep so dangerous, is And for some people, it breaks them as it does this character. It breaks them, but they retreat into a world where they never have to account for what they've done, account for what has happened.
You know, one of the things about this play was I thought it would make an absolutely outstanding episode of the Twilight Zone. And you know, and I th and then you think about the Twilight Zone, and you think almost any episode of the Twilight Zone could be redone as a play.
Absolutely.
And
Absolutely.
two, I think the Twilight Zone, the reason those stories are so important to us in America is I really think of them as the American version of the Greek myths, where you used the supernatural to explore our own emotions. And that's what Serling did beautifully, and you do beautifully here. So talk about using, you know, the edges of our own perception and the distortions that come there as a means to really dig deep into what's good and bad about us.
Yeah, there's a part, because I'm rewriting a part of the play right now where the woman, the character, the woman, is talking about that there are two kinds of people. She's trying to explain to the man that he can't possibly understand what it's like to be an artist because he is a symphony. He goes through his life where everything is pre-written and he follows what's written. And an artist is more like jazz and improvisational, and it has the courage to go deep. And that is dangerous. And then she's asked, why is it dangerous? And she just says, because you can never be the same again. And I think to have you say Serling and me in the same sentence, I think is extraordinary, because what Serling was doing, which I so admire, he was writing plays that were for television. He was, when you watch those 22-minute television plays, because that's what I'm going to call them, they were plays. They are taking our perceptions of what we believe is true and turning it upside down and making someone pull back aghast. One perfect example, that episode, if you remember, where lights start going on and off in this perfect community.
Oh, the
And
monsters are due on Maple Street, one of the absolute pinnacles
incredible,
of his work.
incredible. And I'll never forget. And it applies to today. It's almost Orwellian and like Brave New World, prescient. And there are the aliens on the hill saying, now do you see how it's done? You just throw in a little confusion, lies, and they will turn on each other. So here's Serling taking, at a time in the 50s and 60s, Americana and all this, saying it's not so difficult to tear us apart. When the narrative going on in the country was Pledge of Allegiance and all of this stuff, he's saying no, and he turns it upside down. I think when you are going into the dark side of human beings, the essential part of doing that is telling the truth. And most of the time, we do not tell the truth about ourselves or each other. We just don't.
The new books by Michael Kostakis are Road Songs and A Body in London. Thank you for joining me, Michael.
Thank you so much, Rick. I really appreciate it. It's wonderful talking to you again. Thank you.
You're listening to the Agony Column News Report, featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony.